Blog Talk Radio.
My name is Jawanza, and I am really, really excited. You can probably hear it in my voice. I am extremely excited. It's a beautiful day. I hope you're having a wonderful day, too. Thank you so much for tuning in. To everybody that's tuned in, I can see you on the board. The board is filling up. Thank you so much for your calls. Thank you for calling in. And to all of the listeners, again, you could be doing something else, but you've taken time out of your day to be here with me and my special guest, and you will not regret taking the time to tune in today. Let me tell you, this is going to be one of those shows, okay? As you can tell again from the excitement in my voice, I am very, very pleased to introduce to some my special guest. And for those who, when you hear the name, many of you are going to be like, wow, okay, well, let me get to it. My special guest today is Queen Michelle Shay. Now, Queen Michelle is an award-winning actress, director, and producer, perhaps best known for her Tony Award-nominated performance as Louise in August Wilson's Seven Guitars. She's a veteran performer and has graced stages on and off Broadway, television, and film, and regional theaters across the country. Michelle has appeared in three August Wilson productions, including Seven Guitars, where she originated the role of Louise. She starred as Mame Wilkes in the world premiere of Radio Golf at the Yale Repertory Theater. In 2008, Michelle joined more than 30 actors in the Kennedy Center's August Wilson's 20th Century, where all 10 of August Wilson's plays were performed in a repertory order of their decade. She starred as Aunt Esther in Gem of the Ocean. I saw that. That was awesome. Okay, she directed, that was directed by Kenny Leon. Other stage work includes Home, which was a Negro ensemble company, for Colored Girls, and the list goes on. I mean, from it was Colored Girls by, and I want to pronounce the name right, Nakatsuke Shang. Correct me if I'm wrong, Michelle.
Entozake Shange.
Entozake Shange. Okay, also Coriolanus. With Morgan Freeman, Antony and Cleopatra. She was Cleopatra. And Blues for An Alabama Sky, directed by Israel Hicks. She earned an Obie Award for her work in Meeting by Mustafa Matura. She's appeared on television in The Cosby Show, ER, and Another World, and in film opposite Denzel Washington in He Got Game. Michelle has directed seven August Wilson productions, including Fences, Gem of the Ocean, Seven Guitars with Rebecca Jones at the University of North Carolina School of the Arts, The Piano Lesson, which was at the California Institute of the Arts with Joe Turner, Come and Gone with Tanya Pinkins, Monte Russell, and Glenn Turman at CCAP at the Broad Theater. She's directed a stage reading of King Hedley the second. In 2013, Michelle participated with a host of other longtime August Wilson collaborators in the Green Spaces reading and recording series of August Wilson's American Century Cycle. She directed a reading of Two Trains Running featuring Anthony Chisholm and Tracy Thoms. Other directional work include the musical Ian Forrest, One Woman Shows, Fighting for the Title by Dolores Burgess, and Everyday Diva by Elisa Perry, and The Kink in My Hair, which ran in New York, Toronto, and the National Black Theater Festival in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, She's a graduate of Carnegie Mellon University and is a FOSS grant recipient researching the connection between the human energy system, healing, and performance. She has taught courses, my God, this list goes on, at the California Institute of the Arts, American Conservatory Theater, Actors and Theater of Louisville, Denver Center, and University of North Carolina School of the Arts. And she is currently adjunct professor teaching acting in the new studio on Broadway at New York University, Tisch School of the Arts. She's also a member of the Actors Center Workshop Company founded by J. Michael Miller in New York City. And as you could tell from that bio, that she has really, really, really done a lot of work. And wow, that's all I can say to that is wow. Queen Michelle Shea, welcome to Juwanza for Life. It's great to speak to you again, my sister.
Oh, thank you, Juwanza. It's wonderful to be with you again. I was so happy that we got to meet when we were working at the Kennedy Center doing August plays.
Well, it's truly an honor to have you back, and I'm sure that my listeners are in for a treat because we got a lot of things to talk about. And again, just to, you know, talk to somebody with such a wealth of information, a wealth of experience. You've got a lot to share. My God. Well, let's start here. Because when I look at a list that long with all of the things that you've done, I just want to ask, where did you get started? acting and directing, how did that start?
Well, I mean, the real truth of it is that the arts are a very important thing, and as part of my young development, I was taken to see my first plays. And when the first play that I saw Gloria Foster, who's not with us anymore. She's with the ancestors, but people know her from playing God in what was the name of that movie? The famous movie. Matrix. A lot of people know her from that, playing God, you know. But watching her work so inspired me that it literally changed my life. I thought from that moment on that perhaps being an actor and being on stage could be one of the most powerful things I could do, because it was a place where people could see each other and experience each other differently. And I was very, very moved at that time by all the hell that was breaking loose with riots going on everywhere and racial conflict. And my little young heart just wanted to see something different, because innately I knew that we're spirit and we should recognize the highest connection between all of us. And so that's what prompted me to do it. I used to babysit my life away, take my money and go study dancing in New York and hang out backstage at then it was the Majestic Theater, where Sammy Davis Jr. was playing Golden Boy, because I was able to interview him as a little high schooler and became like so enamored of him as such a consummate artist. And I met the renowned actor Lou Gossett Jr. and told him I wanted to be an actor, and bless his heart, he took mercy on me and listened to me do a monologue from the play that I saw Gloria Foster in, and he was the first person to tell me I had talent and literally coached me for my auditions for Carnegie. And truly it was because of him and his work with me that I got in school, because at that time I had never been in a play. All I knew is that that was something that I thought that I wanted to do. So that's really how I got started.
But did you ever envision that when you did get started that you would have such a long? I mean, I know that's the plan, you know, to have a long career. But when you think of the places that you've been, the people that you've met over the years, just through your exposure to acting, It may have never crossed your mind that you would have such the longevity that you've had, and to have met the, you know, the people that you've now come to know as friends and colleagues, and just to, you know, have that experience. That must be very heartwarming to you. And when you look back,
Yeah, it's amazing. No, I never dreamt that. I think that some part of me didn't doubt I was going to work. I don't know why I didn't doubt I was going to work. I think that was naivety in a way. But the truth is that I had my first professional job by the time that during my junior year in school, and I was helped by my department to leave to go take that job, and I didn't even go to graduation because I was working then too. I was a member of the Tyrone Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I was there for like 3 years, and then I came to New York and started working with the Negro Ensemble Company, the famed Negro Ensemble Company, at the New York Public Theater, where I worked with Morgan and Coriolanus, among other things, and did Miss Summer's Night Dream opposite William Hurt and stuff like that. It was one of those things that made it fortunate, though, was that it was such a good time because it was the big spurt period of the Black theater in New York. And the development of regional theaters, things like the Kennedy Center, were just getting started then. So we were being trained to be parts of companies at that time out of school. So I was very well trained, and that helped tremendously. And I just was bold, and I had a strong will, and I would go after the people that I thought I wanted to work with, and I was lucky, all of those things together, and I was able to have extraordinary experiences.
Well, you mentioned Sammy Davis Jr., Lou Gossett. Who were some of the other people that inspired you, that you looked at and said, you know, just got courage, information, inspiration from? Who were some of the other those
Well, it's all that group of people. I mean, one of the most important people was Sidney Poitier, who I adored. And when I moved from New York to L.A., I had the good fortune when I was in New York, Mr. Poitier came to see me do a play in New York called Split Second, which actually Berry Gordy had option to make a movie out of, but he never did. But Sidney came to see the play, and from that opened the door to actually getting to spend time with him in Los Angeles. And I would go sit in his office and have him talk to me about the business, and he would let me come and watch him shoot. Also, there's a person that your listeners may not know him, but he was very important, was Harold Scott, who was the first artistic director of a regional theater in New York, regional theater, Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park. He was instrumental with introducing me to Lloyd Richards, the famed Lloyd Richards, who did the original Raisin in the Sun, and he also directed Seven Guitars, which I did on Broadway, and he's the one who discovered August Wilson. So all of those things were sort of, I guess, destiny moves, a little destiny moves that were happening. Let's see, Ruby Dee was very important. Running across Meryl Streep was very important. I'm trying to think of who else. Hattie Winston, who was part of the Negro Ensemble Company. Douglas Turner Ward. The whole Negro Ensemble Company experience was extremely important because it was one of a kind experience of tremendous family, tremendous commitment to excellence, and also the coining of our voice as a people through plays, through drama. And they traveled around the world presenting new plays, and many careers were launched from NEC, including Denzel's, from doing Soldier's Play, which people know became a movie. You know, the River Niger and let me see, what else? Home, the play I did, Home on Broadway, that came from NEC. Many of the first of the black actors, like Rosalind Cash, Denise Nichols, Esther Rolle from Good Times, all of those people came from the Negro Ensemble Company and were the first ones, Robert Hooks, to move into television, making way for everybody else. So it was a tremendous company, and in fact they're being honored now through another thing that I work with called Project One Voice with Eric Campbell McMillan, and all across the country, one day, this year's June 15th, one play from the African-American canon is read in multiple theaters around the country and then also echoed in the world. The same play is read. Last year we did Ntozake's play for Colored Girls. This year we're doing Home by Sam Art Williams and honoring the Negro Ensemble Company, which it's the, I think it's the 35th anniversary of Home now. So, as time passes, these benchmarks, you know, get further and further away, and we have to be reminded of all the ones that were the way makers. And that group in particular, Douglas Turner Ward and Lord Richards, et cetera, they went through hell paving the way for us. You know, they went through hell. Now, I mean, the jobs that the young people are able to get, and I'm calling people like Viola, the young people, it's like those jobs wouldn't have been possible like they are mm-hmm. now. So a lot has been done in terms of pushing our way into the psyche of not only America, but the world in terms of recognizing the tremendous gift and importance of the African-American culture in the many, many various forms that we show up. You know, and right. influence.
You know, it's so interesting how you mentioned, you know, the people that were kind of paved the way. And I think that that's probably, when you think about people that have paved the way and trying to share that with an appreciation for the arts and for those individuals with the generations that are following, that are coming behind us, then that's, even when you look at society as a whole, we think about, you know, the people that have paved the way for us and giving honor and recognition to those who labored and, you know, made it easier, who, you know, who broke down barriers, color barriers and so forth. Have you found that when you're sharing with the younger generation, for lack of a better term, that they are open and receptive to hear and appreciate the way that was paved for them by those forerunners?
I think there's a good percentage that are and some aren't, but I think what is true is they're all looking for mentorship, you know, from somebody, and they're eager for mentorship. What I see going on that's very exciting is here in New York, watching the young leaders start to emerge. They're earning their stripes and paying their dues, going through hardships, trying to create institutions and stuff like that. But they're shining like new money. They're wonderful, powerful, creative people, and they're using all the new social media and everything to draw in audiences in ways that nobody thought about before because they really reach for the people. And then there are others that are really making way in film and television. And the thing is, you know, there's an illusion that acting is easy and that anybody can do it. But the truth is it's a very well-honed craft because what we're researching is what it means to be a human being. And just like being an athlete or a dancer or a musician, it takes a tremendous amount of time to learn how to invest your soul in the blueprint written by somebody else and give it life and give it meaning. Look at, for example, the movie Selma. Look how much power and influence that has. The commitment in that film took years on everybody's part to bring it through so forcefully that it captures the imagination of the people in a way that will live beyond time. I had the privilege of being at the UN in where Selma was shown and Anne DuVernay was there speaking to young people about it. Young people whose bodies have not paid for the price of freedom, you know. And so it's very important that this kind of thing be done in a way so that it resonates very, very deeply in the psyche, and hopefully so that those events don't have to happen again. That's the power
Everybody,
of the story.
My special guest today is Queen Michelle Shea, and already I can tell that this is going to be a very, very powerful, powerful interview filled with a lot of information. And I just want you to know that if you're listening on your phone, all you have to do is press 1 if you'd like to speak with my special guest. And if you're listening online and you'd like to speak with Queen Michelle, all you have to do is dial 347-324-5727. Again, that's 347-324-5727. By the way, I just want to let you know, Queen Michelle, I was going to surprise you today. Brother Luke,
yes.
Brother Lou Gossett Jr., he is actually attending a graduation, and he was like, Juanza, listen, I got to say hi to Michelle, okay? So let me call in. I'm at this graduation, but, you know, it hasn't started yet. But as soon as it starts, I'm going to have to run, but I just want to say hi to her. But before, your resume is so full that he had to go before I finished reading.
No, you should have just interrupted us.
He might call back. But Clifton Davis, I spoke with Clifton Davis today. He wanted to tell you hi. Unfortunately, he wouldn't have been able. He was doing something and he wouldn't be able to call in during this time, but he wanted me to pass along his greetings to you.
He's one of those people I used to watch on stage in my early days in New York. I saw him do a musical, Two Gentlemen of Verona, on stage on Broadway. It was fantastic, among other things I've seen him do.
Well, let's talk about another aspect. I mean, you do so much, before I get to the other aspect, let me ask you this. When it comes to Broadway versus film, do you have a preference? And my thought is that Broadway might be the real test, okay? Because in film, of course, you've got the cutting room floor where they can edit stuff and, you know, all of that. But with Broadway, you're out there in front of a live audience. You know, there's no bloopers. I mean, if you mess up, everybody sees it. So is there a preference that you have between film and Broadway?
Well, I really like the live connection with the audience. There's nothing like what happens between an audience and a performer. And after all, that's how I got hooked on this whole thing. What I love about film is the opportunity for the camera comes into you, and so you have the opportunity to reveal more about a character because it can see a lot more that you don't necessarily see when people are that far away from you, like in a Broadway stage, you know. On a Broadway stage, generally you have about 1,000 people watching you.
Mm-hmm.
And to sustain that for 8 performances a week to me is equivalent of being an athlete. You have to be really, really, really strong to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a lot out of you. It's very, very joyful. Last year I had the privilege of, I wasn't on stage with him, but I was the standby for Raisin in the Sun, which won the Tony last year, that Kenny Leon directed, that Denzel did, and Anika Noni Rose, and Sophie Okonkwo, and who won the Tony too for playing Ruth, and LaTanya Jackson was in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like watching what happens when busloads and busloads and busloads of people come to see you, and you have to deliver an exceptional product. And the same happens with film, but in a different way. I mean, it's stretched out, but it takes tremendous concentration and tremendous skill to be able to tell a story that way. And I love both of them. I think they help each other. It's like if you're Starbucks and you have coffee, you just don't have it in one city, do you? You got to have a lot. You got to be able to do it in a lot of different ways. Right now, you even have to do it on web series and all of that. I haven't done a web series yet. People are making movies on iPhone 6s and stuff like that. So there are many, many different kinds of stages, and each of them have a different discipline about them. But you got to love them all. They each challenge you, you know, just like the athletes who do, I don't know if you pay attention to the people doing skiing and whatever. Human beings are always challenged to do things in a different way. So who knows what else we'll be doing as time goes on, what stages and what we'll be asked to do. But I hope I answered your question.
Did you? Right. What about teaching? I mean, you're teaching now.
I got to ask you a question, though.
Okay.
You coined me queen today. What made you do that?
Well, when I say queen, there's something in all of us. I think there's something royal in everybody. You know, whether people are conscious of it or not, there's this spark of divinity that rests and resides in each and every person, whether black, white, rich, poor, male, female, you know. When I speak to queen, when I say queen, I'm actually speaking to that highest part of you, you know, that spark of divinity in you. And so it's because I think that since that divinity is in all of us, so, and I'm fond of saying the word namaste, you know, I bow to that divinity.
Yeah.
So that is why I called you queen. It's in honoring that the God in you, that spark of divinity that resides in all of us.
Oh, thank you. That's the same way I feel about everyone, too. And that's like, if I could say that the one thing I try to do in my work is to have people recognize that spark of divinity through whatever character I'm playing. Mm-hmm. I like to do the same thing when I'm teaching. I don't mm-hmm. call it that, but I try to get the young people to recognize and honor the uniqueness that's in them. And there's so much programming in us to the contrary. It's a lot of elbow grease to sort of like get all the doubts out of the way and just allow that beautiful light to come through and shine. When it happens, that's the most exciting thing in the world to me in a classroom or when I'm directing something. And also, of course, when it happens to me. I know for me, one of the most important things I discovered was where I go to meditate within and the place that I go to create with the same place, the same fountain, the same source. And when I understood that, then I invite that intuitive, enlightened fountain that never runs out to influence whatever I'm doing on stage.
Mm.
And so then in terms of that, that's what got me interested in exploring energy and stuff and healing, was because I knew that, I mean, part of the thrill of being a performer is that this amazing energy flows through you. And when you're lucky, you experience this fantastic state of freedom and spontaneity inside, and you don't know where it came from. You go, how did I do that? Because you don't know. You kind of fall down a rabbit hole, and there it is. And so I started to wonder what would happen if we really consciously knew what we did with energy and performance. Could you more deeply affect people? And so I started to look for artists that were healers, and I got this Fox Foundation grant, which let me do it. I found artists that were healers. One of the main ones was a woman named Laura Fine, is a woman named Laura Fine, who was a theater director who created something called the Energy System of Acting, which utilized the human energy systems, the chakras, as people are familiar with who study yoga, to awaken this very authentic, deep state and connection with your higher self when you perform. And also it helps to move the blocks out of the way. Then when I started studying that, then she said, you need to study what's behind it. And then she was teaching something called transpersonal energy healing, which is based on Barbara Brennan's book. And it that work through touch It's called chelation, certain patterns of how you touch the body, awakens the body's own self-healing mechanism within it. And, ooh, baby, that's like, that's amazing. I call it, it's like the Rolls Royce features we don't know that we have. They're little, you know how in a fancy car they got these little fancy buttons?
Yep.
And if you know what that button is, all kinds of things can happen. That's the way I feel about the energy system. It's our fancy little buttons that we don't know where they are. And once you know where they are, the being in the body is a whole different experience. And so that's what started to happen to me. And I've been studying healing in one form or the other and practicing healing in performance and with clients ever since. So it's been since about, let's see, I got the grant in 1997. And so it's, you know, part of my life now. And it's an amazing journey. And it's been responsible for, you know, like you saw, Gemma, the ocean, it's been responsible for some of illuminating, helping me illuminate some of the best work I've ever done on stage, especially on Esther and Gemma, the ocean.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned Barbara Brennan. I actually read her book. This was probably about 1998, excuse me. And it was amazing. It was up until that point, you know, I had heard of healing modalities like Reiki and, you know, sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I read her book. There was just something about her book that really, really spoke to me. And I don't know if she's written anything since, but that book was really, really powerful. And it's interesting that you bring her up. And that had to be something even for you to, you know, get into this whole energy work, because that is something that's always interested me, because we can feel energy, but and we're affected by energy. We meet people, we feel their vibrations, and, you know, just the, even the energy systems in the body for healing, you know. So when I think of energy work, I'm always amazed at people that do energy work, because, again, you're dealing with the vibration of a person. I mean, and to actually heal, you're talking about, you get, like you mentioned, you get into the chakras, and to work on that level, that's a very, very subtle level.
It's
and
very
a lot
intimate.
Of,
it's very yeah. intimate. We talk about intimacy. It's very intimate, and it also teaches you tremendous empathy and compassion, because you start to not be judgmental when you discover places of pain and blocks, because we... all of us, you can't sort of be human without being wounded. It's a miracle that you don't get wounded. But the truth is, there's a gift that's created from every wound, and that any wound that's in the body, basically through energy work and through working with beliefs, etc., and with the emotions holding trauma trapped, we can be freed. That's why I say they're Rolls Royce features. We were designed to heal ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We're designed to heal ourselves. And that is a miraculous thought. That's also what keeps me being an artist, because from studying other things, I discovered how powerful story is. We model and imprint to story, to people. And so therefore... When as artists we create things, either dance, music, anything that's engaging the senses, what it does is it, at its very best, Juwanza, it throws us into a state at the highest is called Shantarasa, in which you can experience bliss within. You can literally go into a meditative state when an artistic experience is at its highest. This is one of the reasons why music thrills us so. Because when you think about it, how stoned we get from listening to music. It's because literally the sound, each note is vibrating a certain chakra, and It's in training you. The word is entrainment into a state of being, and that state can turn you within to your higher self and to experience that divine spark. So that's part of what keeps me doing it. It's like searching for how do I do that on a regular basis as an artist? And then again, how do I do that? How do I live that all the time in my life? And so that's why you do practices like meditation and things to still the mind so that you can drop into that place inside yourself. It's very powerful.
You know, and it sounds like it. And as I'm listening to you, you just made me really think about consciously think about the effect of sound. You mentioned music, and, you know, even as I thought about that, I thought about people who chant, and just that,
yes,
you know, the that is made, and how that sound, that tone is resonating on a different chakra and can take you, you know, to different places. I mean, if you think of just even people who meditate, I'll just give a visual image of a group of monks or a group of people just chanting, and you can see that they're gone. They're physically there, but their eyes might be closed and they're gone. You know,
right? And that's because that the vibration of the tone, the in fact, one's voice toning is one of the most powerful healing tools there is. Just you, the sound of your own voice, singing whatever you feel like singing, is extremely healing practice. It's very soothing to the body. Each note vibrates at a different, it's like each note is really a medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Mm.
And you can about that.
Do you think that culturally that different sounds affect different people, different cultures differently? Because as I think of, you know, Africans and African Americans, I mean, our music tends to be, when you talk about R&B, again, it's very drum heavy, very bass heavy, you know.
The drum is for the heart. The drum is to open the heart. Yep.
And then you see other cultures.
Still the mind. Yeah.
Okay. Because other cultures, it might be, you might hear violins and, you know, harps.
Yeah. And it's the whole world, actually, I don't remember exactly how it is, but the whole world exists in the movement of the musical chords, because there's major and minor chords in different parts of the world vibrate to certain chord progressions, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So you're right on about that. You're right on. But high notes, for example, open to higher chakras. For example, I can't sing real high notes, but you know the impact of a high note. Just think about certain notes hitting you. Music is very grounding.
Mm-hmm.
Very grounding. It's connected to the earth. And I feel like the American Indians, there's an understanding that Africans have about the connection between the earth and the sky. And that's one of the reasons why the dancing is so strong in terms of the connection to the earth, I think. And hitting your feet against the earth does something.
Mm-hmm.
It communicates with her in a particular way. It awakens something, you know?
As you mentioned, the Native Americans, I pictured that when you mentioned it. The first image that I had in my mind as soon as you mentioned it was a Native American, for lack of a better term, stomp. You know, Native American.
Yeah, that's right.
Where they're hitting, that foot is hitting the ground, and, you know, it's like, they've connected.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that culture in particular, it's like everything, their relationship with nature and everything, is they recognize the spirit in everything.
Mm-hmm.
Everything. And have, like the shamans and all that, they have very active relationships with the spirit within everything, and many of us don't believe that, but that has been their experience.
You know, speaking of Native Americans, I thought that what I read a while back was very, very beautiful, that they were so connected to everything around them, even down to the animals. So if the warriors or the hunters were out on a hunt, that they would actually thank the animal that they were about to spear, you know, or shoot with the bow and arrow. They would actually thank the buffalo or thank the rabbit for the life that it was giving to be food on that table. You know what I mean? That they would actually thank the animal for the life that they were going to ultimately take, but they were looking at it like, okay, this is our little four-legged brother, you know what I mean? And he's going to, or she's going to be our dinner tonight, but before we kill it, we're going to thank it before we do what we have to do to feed the family. And I thought that, wow, that was deep to me because, you know, we actually, you know, when oftentimes when people come together, they might say a prayer over their meal and thank God. But who thanks the food? Who thanks the fruit for being on the table?
Yeah.
You know, who thanks the vegetable? Who thanks the greens? Or who thanks the salad? Who thanks the tomato, you know, for being on the plate? You know, I thought that was a real connection with nature, and I thought that was beautiful.
True, and I think a lot about sacrifice, and I think part of that is because that's one of the things that August Wilson deals with in his plays, and so I've come to realize that, you know, like that animal, that chicken, that cow, that whatever, basically is giving his life so that you can live. He's surrendering his life so you can live. That lettuce is surrendering his life so that you can live. That flower is surrendering its life and radiance so you can appreciate beauty. Trayvon Martin, all these people that have died, I think about them as offering their lives so that consciousness can shift about police and people killing people that shouldn't be killing people. So like Christ died on the cross, it took Christ's body, it took Christ dying for men to realize something. And so somehow the other, so far in our life as humans, these are my little speculations, there's nothing grounded in anything, but I think about this, somehow we seem to require sacrifice before we move.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that there's a position, and I love it, just from some of the things that I've read and studied, that even our identification as humans is the actual root cause of a lot of the situations that are going on, the negative situations that are going on the planet, that in reality that we are divine. And when we make that connection with that as our identity, that we are that spark of divinity in us, that we are, like, for example, if God is the ocean, then we are the drop of water, but we're made up of the same stuff. Drop of water is made up of the same stuff that the ocean is made up of. But if we just identify ourselves with the drop and not the ocean, and not know that we have the ability to tap into the same essence that is the ocean, that we have the same ability to tap into that divinity, because when we, for example, let's look at slavery just briefly, that when you think of slavery, slavery was instituted by people. It wasn't instituted by ignorant people. You know, there were a lot of people over in England and different places or whatever. These weren't the uneducated people that, you know, started this whole institution, you know, of slavery. There were some very intelligent people that started this. These were what people would consider humans at their, you know, highest in terms of, you know, their education. So, but even at their highest of their education, they still found no problem with, you know, owning slaves and treating people in what we would consider inhumane. But if you look at that as being, okay, these were the highest, the highly educated. This was the height then of humanness. So if at the height of humanness you can do that, then, for example, slavery and murder and, you know, all of this rape and all that's not inhumane. That is actually humane. That is what humans do. But if you view yourself as I am divine, okay, and we actually strive towards attaining that and saying, no, I'm not human. I am actually a divine person, or I am, and we've heard it said before that I am a spirit and having an earthly experience, okay, then I am spirit. I am that which created this human body. I am that which created the sun, the moon, the stars. I am one with that. Then, you know, we have a lot to, you know, aspire to, and that is a very lofty identification. But, you know, what better role model could have than to saying, you know, I am divine.
Yes, absolutely. And wrestling with that duality, I find it's like once you either fall into a space where you experience that you are more than just this body, more than just this human being, either through somehow a direct experience or through meditation, then wrestling with that duality becomes part of your journey, because you always know that there's something more than the way things appear. So again, bringing it back to drama, in a way, people are playing parts of the good guys and the bad guys for the sake of us discovering that divinity in everything, in every situation, perhaps. It's just like going to the gym. So it's like finding your way out of a maze or something. I mean, not going to the gym, but like finding your way out of a maze. And it's like the aha moment. I remember my meditation teacher used to tell a story about the musk deer running and running, being attracted by some smell and not knowing where it came from until finally exhausted, it falls down, its nose hits its own navel, and the musk deer, the smell that he's so attracted to is coming from within. So it's coming from within. And then I know also, I can't believe I'm going to tell you this, but I remember one of the first experiences I had when I was in meditation. I practice something called Siddha Yoga meditation, which includes the awakening of the Kundalini energy through Shaktipat, the descent of grace through a realized master. And so, and this was very, very a big departure for me, because I was raised Roman Catholic and sort of confused about how I sort of rectified both things. And one of the experiences I had was I would get little visions of things, commercials I would call them, to explain to me that there was no difference between what I had studied and this new experience, this awakened energy that I was feeling in my body. And so one of the things I saw, I was in a theater, and I saw consciousness on a stage, like vibrating energy, and I heard this voice say, no matter what part I play, I always remain the same. So there's a part of you that does not change. And we become aware of it, like when you first wake up in the morning, when you go, I slept well last night, I didn't dream last night. Well, who is the person watching? What is that that's watching the whole thing? Who is the witness in that, you know? Or when you look at a sunset, or you make love with someone, or your heart explodes with love. I remember the very first experience I had was feeling love awakened in me, an ocean of love awakened in me without ever having a person there. Now, and you know that blew my mind. And it's like in HeartMath, this is an organization called HeartMath, it says there's enough energy in one heart to fill the world. All the electrical output in one heart can fill the whole world. They're doing studies on it now.
Wow.
So, you know, We're amazing beings. We're amazing beings. And I often think now that we should try to problem solve on an energy level first and then come down to a physical level, because we have to turn the ship around so we are awakened to who we really are. I think it's an inevitable thing, but how difficult we make it is really up to us, Juwanza. How difficult,
you know,
we make it.
I think you're right. I think that it is inevitable. And I think just for the sake of the planet and for the beings on the planet, there has to be a purpose. I mean, when you think about and ponder deeply the meaning and purpose of life, when you think about it, I mean, when you really sit back and think about life and you look at the sun and you look at the constellations and you think about, okay, this was created. There was an intelligence behind this because, for example, if every human, quote, end quote, being is born, quote, normal, end quote, then they have two eyes to see, you know, two nostrils, two ears, you know, reproductive organs, hands to grasp, feet to walk, you know, and there has to be an intelligence that created all of this. I mean, even when you think about the senses, you know, the sense of taste, sound, hearing, seeing, and touch, you know, there has to be an intelligence behind this. Because if, for example, one is off, something is off, you know, a person might be born with, you know, four fingers instead of five, or, you know, an extra thumb or something, they're considered to be not, quote, normal, end quote. But, you know, back to the intelligence, there has to be an intelligence involved in this. And back to the statement you were talking about, it's inevitable that we come into this realization, because what would be the point of this intelligence if it was not for everybody to at some point realize that this is who they really are?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And the
everybody,
biggest
I wanna...
thing is that it's hidden. That it's hidden,
huh?
You know?
Yes.
It's hidden from us, you know, like mm-hmm. the musketeer. We don't recognize it's there. You must turn within to find it.
I want to give everybody else, again, there are people online. I can see you on the board. If you have a question and you just want to say hello or you just want to make a comment, please press 1, and then I'll bring you on board. My special guest today is Queen Michelle Shea. I am enjoying this. This hour is going by so fast. I know I'm going to have you back, and we're going to have to keep this conversation going because I am really, really enjoying this. Could you talk about meditation for a moment? I would imagine that you meditate before you go out there on the stage or at some point. Do you suggest? I meditate, by the way, daily. But do you suggest meditation? Oh, you mentioned Siddha meditation. Was that the
Siddha?
Okay, Siddha meditation, and that is part of Siddha yoga. That's a part of a yoga form.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. What role does meditation play in your life?
Well, it's kept me out of Bellevue because the times that it has. First of all, I mean, what it introduced me to was the inner self. You know, this place of spontaneity and bliss and wisdom and everything inside once this kundalini energy was awakened. And I found that, like being raised Roman Catholic, all of a sudden the principles that I had studied but thought were totally unattainable to experience through my Roman Catholic upbringing suddenly became tangible and real, and I went, oh, I understand that. And I find that's true with every religion where there's a sincere quest to experience God. I experienced the same thing. I remember sitting one Easter Sunday up in with the gospel choir at Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem, and going crazy, experienced this energy, this Shakti energy, while I was sitting there, because everybody had their hearts were so full of love as they sang. So it's a universal experience. So just like water is water, no matter what language you speak, the experience to me anyway of the divine is the same in all cultures and all times. It is what's underneath everything. And so the act of meditation, as you know, is like turning your attention within. When our attention is without, like watching television, we're concentrating on an outer object. And so when we turn within, there are several ways to do it. You can do it with a mantra or a high thought, or even with the wonderful movement of your breath, which I really, really love. You know, one long inhalation, Let the breath stop for a minute and then exhale long and deep. And as you do that, you start to, the body automatically starts to fall into a quiet state, a simple state, and then the mind starts to become still. And we hardly believe that the mind can be still, but behind that is great power and focus and peace in doing that. And so I sit to meditate, but I also do it like all the time in New York, some little meditation, riding the subway, whatever. It's how I get through the city. And definitely when I go through trauma, which is how I learned to appreciate meditation the most, is when I was really upset or really sad, the only way to get consolation was to turn within, and that's when I would discover this vast support system inside that I probably wouldn't have discovered had I not been so miserable at any given moment, you know. And then before performance, I ritualistically sit for at least 15 minutes and meditate and tune into my intuition and warm up my chakras and all of those things to get myself into a high state of connectivity with that energy. And it's delicious. So did I answer that okay?
Love the words you
said. And the other, yeah, and then, and also with your body too, just like I love Kundalini yoga for putting you in state. Hatha yoga is great for that. I love Qigong for doing that. It helps to put you in a meditative state. Sometimes even walking, a good walk will start to put you in that state. Also watching nature, being with nature. I love to watch the water, sit and listen to the water and watch the water, to be in the sunshine, to be around trees. All of those things tend to, for me, turn me within.
You know what? I am sitting over here in a state of, what's the word? This is my kind of show here. I mean, I'm sitting over here being fed, and you are definitely, we're in tune. We're definitely in tune, because this is, we're definitely vibrating on the same frequency, because this is what I do, you know. This is the food that I eat, you know. And so I'm just honored to have you on as a guest, and I'm going to have you back because this is food. And I know that the listeners, they're still on. Don't be shy. If you have a question and you want to say hi, just press 1 and I'll bring you on board. We have a few moments left. Could we talk about the Essene? You mentioned that,
earlier. Yeah.
Could you talk about that, and for, you know, the listeners that don't know that type of work, and even Essa, what you're doing with that? And if you don't mind, I don't know if you have to, if this has to be a hard hour for you, or if you can go a little bit over.
No, I can go a little bit over. But I would refer people, the easiest thing for the energy system of acting, people can go to Lionheart, www.lionheartinstitutewest, and that is my teacher's website, Laura Fine. I'm also on there, but you can, she has the workbook she's created for energy system of acting, which isn't going to tell you everything. I mean, it's profound what's there. It would be helpful to work with a teacher, but at least you can read about it if you'd be interested. Also, you can go to my website, www.michelleshea.com, to read more about it, because I like to, when I'm working with coaching and stuff, help to awaken people's energy centers through Qigong and energy system of acting, because then it's like all systems go. I would work, your whole system is ready to respond to whatever stimulus comes in front of you. And each chakra represents a certain quality of expression. So the first chakra, how much time do I have?
I
have time to do this? Okay.
Yeah.
So the first chakra is the base chakra, and it's like at our tailbone, perineum is low, and it's responsible for our ability to walk and to move. and our sense of security and stuff. Low notes are there. So the I am-ness comes from there. Our no comes from there. The warrior comes from there. You know, the heaviness comes from there. The vowel sound would be like that. So I'm going to kick some butt. You know, when you really want to go after somebody, that's first chakra energy. And that is earth, the element of earth. So I'm demonstrating that in my voice. You hear how deep my voice is getting. It's very grounded. It's soothing. You feel like you can trust me, all of that. That's why we like all those low notes in the blues and stuff like that. It's very grounded. It's very in your body. If you move up slightly, 2 inches below the navel is the area of the second chakra. It's the water element. It's the center of sensuality and creativity in the body. Everything is curvaceous, moves and stuff like that. And it's a little bit lighter and flirty. It's the energy is to pull somebody in. It's I want. And the vowel sound would be ooh. And it's juicy and feels good and delicious, right? So whenever we like something, we relax into it, then you're activating the second chakra. Then you move up towards the solar plexus area. And that is what I call the oh my goodness area. It's the place where laughter comes from. It's the place where enthusiasm and excitement and the vowel sound is excitement, fear. Mm-hmm. The back side of it is fear. The front side of it is enthusiasm. But as you get up into that place, then you start to feel more energized and excited and stuff like that. Then you move up higher to the heart chakra. The color for the heart chakra is green. The vowel sound is ah. And also from the heart up, it includes up into the lungs, across the shoulders, into the arms, the wrists, and the hands. The arms and the shoulders and the hands are extensions of the heart chakra. That area of the body is where we hold esteem. So you notice if your shoulders are turned inward, then you're sheltering and protecting your heart. When they're open, you're full of esteem and ready to engage. And that's the place that's the center of love for one person and for the whole world. Whenever we get hurt, we shut down the back of the heart chakra. And so, like, one of the things you want to do, we hold grief in our lungs, that whole area of the body. So you want to move that around in order to get all the cobwebs and the stuckness off of you. All you need to do is breathe and move to activate your chakras. They oscillate and change and move all the time. They don't stay steady. They're very sensitive, one with the other. Moving up from there, you have the throat chakra, which is in the throat. That is where we speak our truth. And when it's blocked there, your throat could get tight. When you feel like you may have throat problems there, the vowel sound for that is like I use the diphthong I. I have the right to speak my truth. Opening the jaw, yawning, humming sounds, all of those things open up that area. And as you start to get up to there, then you start to not feel your body as much. The heart is the turning point. You start to feel out of the body somewhat. These are the higher centers. Then you move to the space between the brow, the sight, the place of intuition, also ideas and quick thought. And that is the Ajna chakra. And the color for that chakra is blue, sky blue, and the sound would be hey, hey, and it's from it's clear sight. So like, you know that song, I can see clearly now, the rain is gone. So all it has to do with is this sense of vision, being a vision. So when you envision something, you get a vision for something. It's happening from there. When you get intuition, insight beyond what's in front of you. It's coming from that center. Also, when it's narrow, it's when we think too much and we say that you're in your head. Okay? Then for the seventh chakra, that's at the top of our head, like the yarmulke part. You tap your head at the top there, and that is the seat of wisdom in the body. And when that's not open, it's like being in a room where the ceiling is too low. You don't get enough information from spirit coming into you. The royal color of purple is the color for that. You can tap the top of your head and that begins to open that up. You could raise both of your arms up in the air and let them spread until you start to feel energy coming into your body. This is one of those Rolls Royce features. And that opens up the seventh chakra, and you feel energy coming into your body, going down into the earth. And if you're a leader, for example, you would want to awaken the seventh chakra and also your first chakra, because then you have groundedness with great wisdom and vision. So that's like an idea. Now, you can warm all of them up just by going through colors. Red is the color for the first chakra, so you could breathe in the color red and exhale the color red. Moving up, you can breathe in the color orange for the second chakra and sensuality, and exhale the color orange. For the third chakra, the enthusiastic chakra, the solar plexus, breathe in the color yellow and exhale the color yellow. For the heart chakra, the color green and pink, or pink. Pink is for relationship, like love relationship. Green is for loving everybody. Breathing in those colors. For the throat chakra, it's the color blue, cobalt blue, really vibrant blue, breathing that in. For the sixth chakra, it's sky blue, breathing that in and out. And for the seventh chakra, it's breathing in and out the color purple. And that's something that you can do. And just doing that begins to communicate. The body understands that. So if there's a block, you'll start to get vibration just from even doing those colors.
I'm sitting here smiling.
Was that helpful?
Yeah.
Did you try it, Jawanda? Did you try it? Did it feel good?
Absolutely.
It makes
and
you feel fabulous.
I work at a metaphysical shop, and it was a crystal shop in Georgetown. Those of you in D.C. might remember Earth Star Connection in Georgetown. I used to work there, and they sold crystals and, amongst other things, metaphysical paraphernalia, incense, smudge sticks, you know, all of that, everything that would, you know, go along with a metaphysical store. And they had all kinds of crystals from, you know, clear quartz, smoky quartz, tiger eye, you know, rose quartz, everything. And one of the things that was said to me was, whatever, pick a stone, you know, just choose a stone. You got all these different stones here, you know, just a wide variety of stones. And whichever crystal you are drawn to, then that shows something about, you know, who you are and your personality. Now, I'm a guy, okay? Now, I wouldn't normally, you know, I wouldn't wear anything pink or anything like that. But for whatever reason, the rose quartz, this beautiful pink stone, this rose quartz crystal was just drawing me, you know. And I had to, that was what I went to, you know, and it was curious to me. I was curious about, why are you so drawn to this pink stone, you know? And I would, you know, get this pink stone, and I would carry it with me, and I actually had a necklace made out of the stone and would wear it under my shirt, and it hung down right above the heart, where the heart chakra is, you know? And so I just thought it was interesting when you were going through the chakras and you shared what you shared concerning...
Pink. Mm-hmm. Pink.
What would a person's favorite color... Now, pink's not necessarily my favorite color. I like the rose quartz, but... would a person's favorite color say something about them and their chakras? For example, you might have somebody whose favorite color is blue. I mean, would that say something about them?
Well, it means that you need more blue. You need more of that color chakra. That's usually what it means, that you're trying to enhance that aspect. You know, there's like, it's not, you're not getting enough of it. So that's what it tends to be. Or you might, you know, like the need to wear red one day.
Mm-hmm.
Red is the first chakra or whatever. I know for me, like turquoise is also a color for the throat chakra, and I've been in love with turquoise for a while now. You know, I've gone from red, purple, I did purple for a long time. So it's just a little communications to you.
Wow. This has been a powerful, powerful interview. I have truly, truly loved it. And I'm sure that my listeners have too. And you say you do coaching for people who are hearing this, because it's not just being heard in the D.C. area. It's Blog Talk, so people could be listening.
Yeah,
anytime.
I do. I coach executives, and I coach in the D.C. area. I worked with NASA for 5 years, coaching NASA executives, teaching them some of this stuff about the chakras. I used to try to hide it from them, but I finally told them the truth about what they were doing. But I work with executive coaches, and I work with artists. But I work with anybody really who comes in and wants to experience their full expressive communicative self, and because I believe that that's a birthright for us, and it's like I say, it's thrilling to discover it. So I work all kinds of ways, but if they go to my website, they can get an idea of that. And then anything else, just let's talk about it. I'm on Facebook and my website, and so people can find me.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is awesome, awesome. Any final remarks that you might have for our listeners? I mean, again, this has been a powerful show. It's been a fast hour. Again, I'm going to have you back so we can continue this delicious meal that you prepared for us. And any final remarks for our listeners?
Well, I just hope that to you listeners, that I said something that may have inspired you and connected you to more deeply love and honor yourself and enjoy your life and being encouraged to get through that next little curve, that opportunity for growth that's been thrown in your path. And may you be blessed. May you be blessed and know your greatness.
Awesome. Awesome, awesome. It's so beautiful to see people who are multi-talented and, you know, multi-dimensional, and universal, who, you know, you've tapped into another side of us. You know, we started off talking about your work in the theater. We started talking about, you know, your acting career. You direct, you produce, you do all of those things, and it's just interesting to see the other side of you that actually coaches and how you incorporate your spirituality with your work, and it's just beautiful to see, and I pray that God, Spirit, you know, continues to bless you, open doors for you, and, you know, just bless you with much, much more success, and I'm, you know, just honored to have the opportunity to speak with you again, my friend, and I bow to you.
Oh, thank you, and namaste to you as well, Jawanza, for doing what you do. Okay.
It's an honor, because I get to speak to people like you. Thank you. I'm going to call
you
after this.
Okay.
Peace and blessings, everybody. Goodbye. My special guest today, namaste, has been Queen Michelle Shea. This has been an awesome, awesome interview. As you can see, this queen is multidimensional, and she is on her purpose. And if you've ever wondered what your purpose was and wondered how do I tap into that divinity within that we spoke about, then definitely check her out. Okay, pull up MichelleShea.com. Start there. Okay, and reach out to her on Facebook. And Michelle Shea, by the way, Shea is S-H-A-Y. Michelle is Michelle with one L. And get the process started. Sometimes we need a coach. Sometimes we need a mentor. Sometimes we need somebody who is where we want to be to help guide us, to help us along this path. Because this journey is full of twists and turns, and, you know, sometimes we don't know what to expect. And like she said, sometimes you just got to breathe. Sometimes you just got to inhale and exhale. Inhale and exhale. Starts with your breath. Thank you so much for tuning in, everybody. You could be doing something else. I truly, truly appreciate you. Again, to Michelle Shea, Queen Michelle Shea, I bow to you. Namaste, my sister. To my listeners, thank you so much for your time. As always, you know I love you. Peace and blessings.